Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. In last week's broadcast, I spoke to you about the rape and murder of a 13-year-old white girl, Mary Fagan, by Leo Frank, her Jewish employer, in Atlanta, Georgia, 107 years ago this week. Now I am going to fill in the details of how the Jewish power structure in its first major operation responded to the conviction of Frank. Frank was the head of the Jewish B'nai B'rith in Atlanta. He was a stockholder in the sweatshop he headed, the National Pencil Company, in whose factory Mary met her death. The Jewish community nationwide, which included massive media operations even then, such as Jewish advertising magnate Albert Lasker's empire and the New York Times under Jewish boss Adolf Ox, united as one to create the impression among the clueless American people that Leo Frank was an innocent victim of Southern Jew hatred, even though the South was by far the most pro-Jewish region of the United States. The Jews bought the very best legal team, legal army is more like it, that money could buy. They filed appeals and motions almost without end at every level of the legal and governmental system, from local courts to the U.S. Supreme Court, from the local judiciary to the governor's mansion. They bought hack writers to produce maudlin stage plays, novels and other books, documentary and dramatic films, and an endless stream of magazine and newspaper articles and editorials. They initiated petition drives sparked by full-page ads in major magazines and newspapers. They enlisted the help of countless bamboozled and ignorant white celebrities and politicians. Most importantly, they brought money, many tens of millions of dollars, to bear on the situation, some of it raised from the white public, moved to a fever pitch of sympathy for a Jewish sex killer of a little white girl, barely into her teens, and induced to fund his cause by the massive propaganda campaign. What did the Leo Frank legal team do with those tens of millions of dollars? You're about to find out. In the text version of this broadcast, I will embed an amazing document as a PDF file so you can read it in its entirety. It's quite an education in how brazenly the Jewish power structure operated, even in the old America of 1914. It's the brief of evidence from the Georgia Supreme Court filing opposing a new trial in the Leo Frank case. It's 143 pages and well worth reading. By the way, we are very lucky that this document has been preserved, along with the full 1,800-page record of the case from the Georgia Supreme Court, of which it is a part. We are lucky because some unknown person stole the 3,647-page original trial records years ago, and they have never been recovered. I'll leave it up to you to guess who might have had a motive to do that. I'll cover the highlights of this amazing document today. In 1914, the Leo Frank forces were trying to void Frank's conviction and get him a new trial. In their attempt to convince the judge in the case, B.H. Hill, to grant their request, they used the massive influx of Jewish money to hire William Burns, the most famous and famously corrupt private detective in the country. They hired numerous agents, including George and James Wren, Dan Lehan, C.W. Burke, a black female prisoner named Annie Maud Carter, and numerous others. A major focus of their campaign was to get witnesses who had testified at the original trial to change their testimony via affidavit. This they did by outright purchase of their signatures, or by tricking them into thinking they were signing something else, or by promising jobs or big money to come once Frank was freed, or when all else failed, by spiriting them away to distant cities under various pretexts so they would be unable to testify or even know that forged affidavits had been presented in their names. They even hired men to make love to female witnesses and promise them marriage in return for cooperation, and tried to get Annie Maud Carter to put poison in a major witness's, Jim Conley's, food. Here are just a few things that the Leo Frank team did, documented in the Georgia Supreme Court brief. They found several witnesses, including a Miss Jimmy Mayfield and Miss Cora Falta and Miss Marjorie McCord, who truthfully stated that they weren't sure if the hair found on the lathe at the pencil factory was the hair of Mary Fagan or not, based on its color alone, and tricked them into signing altered affidavits in which they were purported to say that the hair found was definitely not the hair of Mary Fagan. These altered affidavits also quoted them as saying that the texture of the hair was different from Mary Fagan's, when they had actually made no reference to the texture at all. These witnesses then went to the authorities with the story of how they had been tricked and deceived by agents of Frank. Albert McKnight, a black man whose wife Manola worked as a cook at Frank's home and who saw a very nervous Frank at his home shortly after the murder, and whose wife told him that Frank had confessed to killing a girl to his wife in Manola's hearing, was approached by agents of Frank as follows, and these are his own words. Quote, "The reason I made the affidavit for Burke, an agent of the Frank team, was because he kept on after me. Burke came to me and told me that he would get me a job at the terminal station, making $10 a week, and he said the tips I would get around there would average $100. He asked me how much I was making, and I told him $7 a week. He asked me, hadn't I rather have a job like that than have one just making $28? In today's money, they were offering him a job that paid around $5,000 a month compared to a pittance. I told him yes. He asked me, could he learn me how to drive his automobile? And I told him yes. He says, well then, if you wouldn't like the job around the terminal station, I will learn you how to drive the car and move you into a little house near me, and Manola can work for me if she wants to. The job he got me was a job at a guano house. I wouldn't take that job, and he sent me then down to Schoen Brothers, 325 Decatur Street, packing hides. Schoen Brothers are Jews. I got hurt at a crossing on McDaniel Street. Burke told me that they, the city detectives, were looking for me to make a witness out of me in the Conley case. This is the first I knew they were looking for me. He told me to leave town that Sunday before the Conley case came up the next week. He told me not to let them get me by any means. I asked him if I went to Stockbridge to my mother's, would that be all right? And he said yes. just so I got out of town and didn't let them get me. After I was hurt, they took me down to Fairhaven Hospital, colored. When I was down there, Burke, an agent for Frank, came down and brought a man by the name of Burns, the head detective hired by Frank, and some Jew, whose name I don't know. While I was over at the hospital, while Mr. Burns and Mr. Burke were present, they tried to get me to say that the city detectives beat me up. Mr. Burke come out to my house 3 or 4 times to see me in the afternoon, but he didn't catch me there until he had made the 3rd or 4th trip. And he caught me there at 7:30, and I was in bed, and he sat down and talked to me, the way people do, and as if I had to die, and if I had to die, then did I think I would go to heaven, and all like that. And I said yes, and all the time I knew what he was after, for me to change my affidavit. He wanted me to make another affidavit, and Mr. Burke keeps after me until I would say I would make him one, and so I said, all right, and I said I don't know nothing about it. He said if I hadn't changed my affidavit and told the truth, the Jews were fixing to do something to me. He never did say what they would do, only he said they would kill me if I hadn't changed my statement and told the truth. And I told him that I told the truth the first time, and he says I gained more friends by changing my statement. Close quote. Poor old illiterate Albert McKnight was thus tricked and corrupted into signing 4 affidavits, whose contents he only supposed were what was read to him by Frank's agents Burns and Burke, and later admitted to authorities how he had been tricked and abused into signing them, telling him that he wouldn't go to heaven unless he signed a paper for Leo Frank. Can you even imagine such cynical, malicious acts? The prosecution didn't promise him money or jobs or spirit him out of town or deceive him, as Frank's agents did. In fact, poor old Albert was acting honorably and against his own financial interests. His wife worked for the Franks when he testified against Frank. Poor old Albert, by the way, was instantly fired from the pot washer job the Jews got for him as soon as they had his signature on the last affidavit, something they didn't even need to do. Great friends, these Jews and their agents. Great friends indeed. While the black pencil factory sweeper, James Conley, an important witness against Frank, was in jail for being an accessory after the fact, for helping Frank to move Mary Fagan's body, they inveigled a black woman prisoner of low morals named Annie Maud Carter to get romantic with him and exchange letters with him, some of which were then used as the basis for forgeries purporting to show Conley was a sex maniac and that he confessed in writing to killing Mary Fagan. Even Annie Maud Carter balked, however, when agents for Frank suggested putting poison in Conley's food. She stated, quote, "The first Sunday in December, I was sitting on the 2nd floor, and a Jew came up. Mr. Frank was out there and 3 or 4 more Jews. Mr. Pappenheimer was there with him, too. This Jew asked me, was I out all the time, meaning having the run of the jail as a trustee? And I said, yes. And he said, I want to see you. And I said, all right. And he said, do you know how to get rich right quick? Or have you as much as you want, or more than you will ever be able to dispose of? Do you ever go to talk with Jim Conley? And I says, I am on my way there now. And he said, I want you to do something for me and state your own price. I want you to take this little vial and put a drop. It is dangerous. Don't let it get about your food. And put a drop in his food and give it to him. and will guarantee you will have a pot of money and will be a free girl before tomorrow night. Close quote. In one of the most astounding and revealing statements, Mrs. Carrie Smith, who had testified at the trial that Leo Frank had a bad character and a poor reputation with reference to women and girls, was approached on the street by agents of Frank as follows, in her own words, quote, "A man who had introduced himself to me, who had been passing under the name of Maddox, and who represented himself as a book agent and said he was at work getting up a book on the Frank case, and that his commission on the book would be $40, over $800 in today's money. And he told me if I would sign a certain paper, which he brought to me, he would give me one half of his commission. I refused to sign the paper. Sometime after the trial of the case, I was requested by Marie Karst, one of the girls who had been blackmailed into working as Frank's agent, to meet me for the purpose of going to a show on the 7th floor of the Grant Building. There was no show or place to have a show. This was a ruse. The Grant Building houses not a theater, but the offices of Leo Frank's lawyers. After telling the Solicitor General this April 20, 1914, about how I was gotten up into the Grant Building, I went to the same place in order to see whose office it was. I find that the office they had me go to, in which this man Maddox was seen by me, was the office of Rosser, Brandon, Slayton, and Phillips, and the private office into which I went and where I saw this man Maddox was the office which has on the door thereof the name Mr. Slayton." Close quote. Mr. Slayton, by the way, was John M. Slayton, at that time the governor of the state of Georgia. He was a partner in the law firm that defended Frank. And it was Slayton who, in his last moments in office, would commute Leo Frank's death sentence. And we now know, after digging up these statements that the Jewish media and Jewish so-called academics have kept hidden from us for a century, it was in John Slayton's office that bribes and pressure were used on young women and others to change their testimony. Carrie Smith was offered only $500 or so in today's money. Some were paid over $6,000 in today's money for signing away their honor. And how did the Frank team get one of the factory girls, Marie Karst, to act as their agent and lure Carrie Smith into Slayton's office? By digging up an incident of underage drinking she had participated in at the age of 15 with other girls, all of whom shared a single drink. She was told that this incident would be dragged into court, which would have mortified her parents, unless she went to work for the Frank team, which she did. Her job was to talk to other factory girls who had testified against Frank. There were some 20 of them, and convince them that they could do themselves some good by changing their testimony. At first, they claimed, though, that she would be doing office work. Here are her words, quote, "I was not a stenographer and could not write on the typewriter. Burke stated that he only wanted me to work during the afternoons, and he paid me $2 per day for the afternoons. I worked for him about a week. Burke wanted me to go around and see the girls who had sworn for the state on the trial of Frank about his general bad character. And he wanted me to talk to them and report to him what they said, and see if they would not change their evidence. I saw several of the girls among them, Helen Ferguson and Carrie Smith, and they told me they would not change their evidence because what they swore was true. I did not tell them that I was working for Burke, but merely talked it over with them. One day Burke wanted me to see Montine Stover, who had found Frank's office empty while Mary Fagan was being killed, and talk to her and see if I couldn't get her to change her evidence given on the stand. I did not go to see Montine Stover. One day Burke told me that he was coming out to my house and going to see my mother and tell her that I was going off with him to work on a streetcar case, and that he wanted me to go down and live in the house with Montine Stover and pick her. Burke did come out to my house and saw my mother and tried to get my mother to let me go off to work on the streetcar case. My mother refused to let me do it and would not let me go back and work for Burke anymore. I met Burke and had my talks with him in the private office of Governor John M. Slayton, in the office of Rosser, Brandon, Slayton, and Phillips. One day I asked Carrie Smith, a friend of mine, to meet me up at Governor Slayton's office in the Grant Building. That afternoon, however, I failed to go back to the office because it was raining. Next day when I saw Burke, he said, "I had the best luck yesterday you ever saw. I got Carrie Smith where I want her." Burke told me if Carrie didn't give what evidence he wanted, that he had a friend in an assignation house, a kind of prostitution establishment, that knew Carrie, and that Carrie came down to this house lots of times, and she always called him up every time Carrie was down there and notified him and said that if Carrie didn't give the evidence he wanted, when this girl called up next time, he would go down there. I asked Carrie about this, and she said she did not know anybody by the name of Langley, the man Burke said was meeting her at that place, and she did not know anything about any such house. I have known Carrie Smith since she was a baby. We were little tots together. Her reputation is of the very best. She was never guilty of any such thing as Burke suggested, and I know it. I did not tell Burke anything, but I just listened to what Burke had to say. During the time I was at Burke's office, I would frequently not work over 15 minutes. He paid me, however, the $2 a day as he promised. Close quote. Threatening to take her to court over underage drinking unless she did their bidding. Indicating dozens or hundreds of hours of interviewing everyone she knew, trying to dig up dirt on this one relatively unimportant witness. Threatening another innocent woman with tales that she was prostituting herself at an assignation house unless she changed her testimony. Forging letters and attempting to put poison in a witness's food. These are not the acts of an innocent man. And these are indeed the acts of the Jewish power structure getting its way and using lies and propaganda and dirty tricks. To convert a Jewish sex killer into a poor, innocent Jew persecuted by anti-Semites. I have only been able, in the time allotted me, to bring you a very few of the many shocking statements, showing the mendacity, dishonor, rapaciousness, dishonesty, threats, and cynical manipulation employed by the Frank team and the Jewish power structure in this one case alone. I urge you to read the Georgia Supreme Court document to which I linked on nationalvanguard.org. And if you can, visit leofrank.info and read the entire trial record and familiarize yourself with the case, which has been chronicled on National Vanguard, the American Mercury, and the Leo Frank Case Research Library. Study well, then compare what you have learned with what the Jewish power structure tells you about the case. You will never be the same again. You will understand, finally, how and why and by whom our nations are being ruined. Join with us today and do something about it.